That point, they all got into the van and drove home. Back at Hollywood PD, Hoffman took another recorded statement from Otis Toole, in which he yet again formally confessed to the murder of Adam Walsh and provided a detailed account of the circumstances under which he had committed the act. Toole broke into tears several times during this statement, claiming that he liked the little boy and had only wanted to take him home to raise him to be his own child. He had to kill Adam, though, because he realized the boy was very smart and could probably identify him as his kidnapper. When asked why this, of all the killings he had confessed to, bothered him so much, Toole said, "Because that was the youngest person I ever killed." While that interview was taking place, Detective Hoisington ran into Deputy Chief Leroy Hessler in a hallway. "So how'd it go?" Hessler asked. Hoisington hesitated, but decided he should give the chief an honest answer. This was a pretty important matter, and he wasn't so sure things were running as they should. He explained to Hessler that he was surprised that Toole was cooperating at all, given Hoffman's treatment of the man, and also shared with Hessler some of the details that Toole had told him about the crime when Hoffman was out of earshot. Hessler listened patiently, then asked Hoisington if there was some point to all this. Hoisington hesitated. He wasn't assigned as an investigator to this case, as Hessler knew well, but he was a detective, after all. "I just thought maybe I should write a supplemental report, or at least give Detective Hoffman a formal statement for his files," Hoisington said, still taken by Toole's offhand ghoulishness. "If what Toole told me independently corroborates or contradicts something he said elsewhere, that might be useful." Hessler stared at Hoisington for a moment. "You understand that this is Detective Hoffman's case, right?"
"Yes, sir," Hoisington responded.
"Then you go talk to Hoffman about all this," Hessler said, and walked away. Hoisington made an effort to do what Hessler ordered, but by the time Hoffman and his partner Hickman had finished with Toole, it was past 10:30 at night. When Hoisington caught Hoffman coming out of the interview room, the lead detective warned him to make it quick. Chief Martin had already called a press conference for 11 and was waiting on Hoffman in his office. Hoisington had hardly begun his explanation when Hoffman cut him off. "I thought I told you not to talk to that asshole," he said, pointing inside the interview room where Toole still sat. "He was talking to me," Hoisington protested, "and some of those things he said..." Hoffman held up a hand impatiently. "I heard you. I'll include it in my report," he said. Then he hurried down the hall to confer with Martin. At 11 p.m. during a hastily arranged press conference, Hollywood Chief of Police Sam Martin made the momentous announcement. They had found the man who killed Adam Walsh, and on Monday, Otis Toole would be officially charged with the crime. Toole was a confessed serial killer, Martin told reporters, though of the 35 to 50 murders he had committed, Adams was the only one over which he had expressed any regret. "Listening to him talk about the things he's done makes Charles Manson sound like Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn," Martin said, and Assistant Chief Hessler added his own opinion that Toole's stories were grisly and heinous beyond belief. But as to the murder of Adam Walsh, Hessler said, there could be no doubt. There are certain details only he could know. He did it. Hessler assured reporters that his detectives had been grilling Toole 10 to 20 hours a day for 2 days solid, and that he had finally broken down earlier Friday evening. As to the confessions that Toole had made to Detective Kendrick on October 10th and to Detectives Villa and Terry on October 18th, Hessler was curiously, or not so curiously, silent. As far as the outside world was concerned, then, Jack Hoffman and the Hollywood PD had cracked this case without assistance. Indeed, Martin assured those gathered, they had finally found their man. Otis Toole, already convicted of another crime in Jacksonville, would be returned to that city this night or the following morning, but soon he would face justice for the murder of Adam Walsh. Any reasonable individual would have been inclined to take Martin's assertions as fact. An unhinged psychopath, finally snagged by a system through whose cracks he had tumbled for most of his miscreant's life, had confessed details of a heinous crime only he could have known. It might have been a shame for the murdered boy's family that so much time had passed, and it might be galling if it was learned that his apprehension was almost accidental, and perhaps it was annoying that a public defender would have to be engaged at the taxpayer's expense, along with a costly trial to be followed, were a death penalty handed down, by any number of appeals based on what would be surely specious ground. But despite all that, a grievous wrong could now be righted, and some shred of society's order might be restored. Hollywood, Florida, October 22, 1983. The news of the break in the case was trumpeted across the region on Saturday, and any viewer, listener, or reader who caught it might have assumed that, though it had been two long and agonizing years for John and Reve Walsh, the grieving parents were about to see justice done. John Walsh's stirring response upon being given the news was replayed again and again on network and local outlets. "Just give me 3 minutes alone in a room with this guy." Finally, it seemed, the long-suffering parents would find some measure of relief. However, it was not necessarily the call of Chief Martin or Leroy Hessler as to whether or not Otis Toole would in fact be charged. It is true that a police officer can arrest and charge a suspect at a crime scene or in the course of an investigation during which a suspect makes a confession. Following such an arrest, there is an arraignment, normally held within 24 hours, at which the suspect pleads guilty or not guilty, where bail is set or denied, and at which a public defender is appointed if necessary. In most jurisdictions, the state attorney then has a set period of time, 21 days in Florida, in which to file formal charges or drop the case. In fact, it is not unusual for a case initiated as an arrest to be dropped or negotiated, owing to something overlooked or unknown during the relatively hasty process of arrest. In this instance, however, Toole was already in custody for other crimes, and there was no risk of him fleeing, and thus no reason for immediate arrest. Accordingly, the department took the alternative route toward charging a suspect, that of seeking a warrant for the suspect's arrest on new charges from the state attorney for Broward County. In most cases, a state attorney asks that as much evidence as possible be presented before issuing an arrest warrant, for obvious reasons. No reputable prosecutor wants to be involved in harassing innocent citizens, for one thing, but also, the more ironclad the evidence presented, the easier it is for a successful prosecution to be brought. It was common knowledge among police agencies in Dade County during Janet Reno's tenure as head of the state attorney's office that unless an arresting agency presented its case in fail-safe terms, no warrant would be forthcoming. As a result, Reno compiled a sterling record as a prosecutor, one that eventually vaulted her into the office of U.S. Attorney General. In the case of Otis Toole, a prosecutor in Broward State Attorney Michael Satz's office advised Hollywood PD that the case would be bolstered considerably if physical evidence were obtained that placed Toole at the scene of the crime, or at least confirmed his presence in South Florida during the time that the crime took place. If Hoffman and Hickman had done a more meticulous job of documenting the information revealed by Toole in his confessions to Detectives Kendrick and Villa, and if they had presented the results of their own investigation in a way that made it seem they were independently corroborating what only the killer could have known about the crime, perhaps Satz would not have asked for more. But because Hoffman had not even mentioned the fact of the previous confessions, claiming that he had broken Toole after hours of relentless grilling, the state attorney's request for corroborating physical evidence was not out of the ordinary. For most who heard Chief Martin or Leroy Hessler trumpet the news of an impending charge on radio and television, however, all the fine points of arrests versus warrants were the stuff of inside baseball. What most ordinary citizens believed was that a suspect had confessed to the killing of Adam Walsh, and he would soon be tried and convicted and fried in the electric chair. Good riddance to bad rubbish, on to better news ahead. One of those watching as the news concerning Otis Toole was broadcast across South Florida was Bill Missler, the man who had been on his way into Sears to pick up some supplies for a camping trip on that fateful day when he had seen a neatly dressed young boy go off into the parking lot with a disreputable-looking man who seemed all wrong for him. When Missler heard the news anchor's eager pronouncement that at long last a break had come in the Adam Walsh case,
He glanced up at the television with an interest that soon grew into astonishment. As Chief Martin named the suspect in the case and a picture of Otis Toole filled the screen, Missler jumped straight from his bed. At that moment, certainty filled his mind. The face he was staring at was that of the down-and-outer who'd led the young boy away from the Sears store that day. He had, in fact, witnessed the kidnapping of Adam Walsh, Missler thought, a kind of awe filling him. As other images connected with the story swirled across the screen, Missler could do nothing but gape, his mind whirling. He thought about calling Hollywood police on the spot to recount to them what he'd seen that day, but then he hesitated. As a teenager, Missler had spent a year in prison for his ill-advised participation in a robbery. He had put that all behind him, and he was now a respected businessman, the owner of a successful pest control company. If he came forward and his name and face ended up in the newspapers or on television, who was to say some malcontent wouldn't call in to dredge up his past mistakes? Besides, the cops made it sound like they had Toole dead to rights. There must have been other witnesses who'd seen what happened at Sears that day and had identified the kidnapper. Why else would there be all the hullabaloo? Finally, and though it pained him a bit to do so, Missler convinced himself to let it go. His help wasn't needed. Justice had prevailed. Missler switched off his television and lay back down to stare quietly up at his ceiling. And finally, he fell asleep. The following Sunday morning, Lead Detective Hoffman was quoted by the Associated Press as saying that his men had not yet verified that Toole was in the area the day that Adam Walsh had been abducted, but that nonetheless the suspect knew details of the murder that only the killer could have known. Hoffman was not at liberty to discuss the evidence that the department had shared with the state attorney's office, but he was confident that they had plenty to base a case on. And moreover, if Bill Missler did not come forward to place Otis Toole in South Florida at the time of the kidnapping, there was at least one other person who did. Arlene Meyer, the woman who had taken her daughter Heidi to Kmart for some household supplies less than 48 hours before Adam Walsh went missing, was having coffee at her kitchen table on Sunday morning after Chief Martin's announcement, the newspaper trumpeting the news laid out beside her. She was about to take a sip when Heidi walked into the room and stopped dead. "Mom," she pointed at the picture on the front page, "that's him." Arlene stared up at her daughter, who was already beginning to cry. "That's the man who tried to get me that night in the Kmart." Arlene looked down at the photograph of Otis Toole emblazoned there, then shook her head, fighting the chill that began to envelop her. "Now, Heidi, are you sure?" "I wouldn't say it if I wasn't sure," Heidi said, her voice rising to a near shriek. "That's the man who tried to get me." Arlene Meyer rose to comfort her daughter, and when she finally had Heidi calmed down, she picked up the phone and dialed the Hollywood police. Shortly after 5 p.m. on Monday, Detectives Hoffman and Hickman conducted a formal interview with Heidi, who recounted her memory of the visit to Kmart the night she was accosted. Following the completion of her statement, the detectives presented her with a photo lineup to see if she recognized anyone. "That's him," Heidi said, pointing without hesitation at a photograph of Toole. "There's that big gap between his two front teeth." Following their interview with Heidi, Hoffman and Hickman then interviewed Arlene, who independently selected Toole's photo out of the array they presented her. She told the detectives that following the confrontation between Toole and her daughter, she'd found a Kmart security guard to walk them to her car, and that the big white car that both she and her daughter had seen the man get out of was still sitting in the lot at the time. Furthermore, she told Hoffman, she had driven straight home and called Hollywood PD to report the incident, though the detective couldn't locate any record of that call. Meanwhile, an intensive search for the rest of Adam's remains was underway at the spot near mile marker 126 on Florida's Turnpike, where Toole told detectives he'd left the body. Detectives from Hollywood PD had discovered from the lessee of the property, Sergeant James Carter of the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office, that the guardrail fence that had stopped their progress on the service road the day they'd first visited the area with Toole had been in place for only 10 months.
Carter took them down the faint trail on the other side of the fence to show them that there was indeed a fork in the road, one branch that ran about a mile east to a grazing pasture, the other heading south to a shallow valley where Carter maintained a trailer park. At least that much seemed promising. The day he'd been out here with Tool, the man seemed incapable of any reliable memory. Meantime, Hollywood PD had called in the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, an agency far more experienced and better equipped to conduct the kind of search at hand. FDLE technicians used steel probes to examine the ground on the north side of the fork in the road, where Tool had claimed he'd left the body. In turn, the FDLE was assisted by specialists from the Florida Department of Agriculture, who surveyed the entire area with a special ground-penetrating radar unit. By late Wednesday, the team had identified seven locations just beyond the fence and north of the road as having unidentified objects buried beneath the ground. Because it was nearly dark, they decided to wait until morning to begin the actual digging. Detective Hoffman had flown back to Jacksonville in search of evidence that would prove Tool had been in South Florida at the time of Adam's abduction. In discussing his movements in late July of 1981, Tool had told Hoffman that following his release from the hospital in Newport News, he received a check for $78 from the local Salvation Army to pay for a bus ticket back to Jacksonville. Hollywood detectives followed up, speaking to a Mrs. Hall in that Newport News agency. After a bit of rummaging about, Hall confirmed that, in fact, a check in the amount of $71.93, payable to the Greyhound Bus Corporation, had been given to someone named Otis Tool by her agency on Friday, July 24, 1981. That was the amount the bus company had quoted for a one-way fare from Newport News to Jacksonville, she said. When he arrived in Jacksonville, Hoffman met his counterpart, Buddy Terry, who took him directly to the Duval County Jail, where Tool was being held. Terry was buoyed by the fact that a local judge had just declared Tool competent to stand trial in the boarding house arson that killed George Sonnenberg, but Hoffman couldn't have cared less. He couldn't wait to get to the county lockup, where he took Tool through another recounting of his movements in late July of 1981. Tool told Hoffman that he'd taken the check from the Newport News Salvation Army and walked directly to the nearby bus station, where he'd had to wait for a couple of hours. He said it was nighttime when he finally boarded a bus bound for Jacksonville, and that he was not sure when he arrived back in the North Florida city, though bus schedules suggest it would have had to have been sometime early Saturday morning. Nor was Tool exactly sure what he'd done the moment he stepped down from the air-conditioned bus into the cloying summer heat. Maybe he'd walked to Reeves Roofing to see if they might need him to work that day. Or maybe he went instead to the residence of a Nancy Jackson over on Iona Street, where his wife Rita was staying at the time. Probably he had gone to work and stayed in Jacksonville a pretty good while, he told Hoffman that evening, because he was broke, and his wife was getting tired of staying with this Jackson woman and wanted him to get them a place of their own. Everything was a little hazy in his mind, Tool said, but he did remember that he rented himself and Rita a place in one of Betty Goodyear's rooming houses on East 2nd Street, and that is where his brother Howard came to beat him up for stealing his truck. Hoffman left the matter of the chronology of Tool's movements aside for a moment and returned to the details of the kidnapping and murder. When Hoffman asked what Tool had done with the machete and the shovel he'd used to bury the body, Tool told Hoffman that he had been wondering about that himself. With his mother's house all burned up, he couldn't have hidden those items there, now could he? So what had he done with them, Hoffman wanted to know. And that is when Tool delivered a thunderbolt. That's why I'm trying to give you all these statements, he told Hoffman. I'm not really sure that I really did kill Adam Walsh. Hoffman took a deep breath. So Tool was now saying that he had stayed in Jacksonville to work after he got back on Saturday, July 25th? He was broke and had to make some money before he took his trip to South Florida. Did Tool realize that Adam had been taken from that Sears store in Hollywood on Monday, scarcely 2 days later? Tool blinked, apparently trying to rack his thoughts into something resembling logical order. So the only thing,
If I really didn't kill Adam Walsh, I would have to have been working the Monday on the 27th, he said to Hoffman.
Hoffman leaned back in his chair.
That's the long and short of it, he said.
We'll check the company's records. If you were working on July 27th, then everything you've told us about the murder is a load of BS.
At this point, Buddy Terry could hold himself back no longer. Without asking Hoffman, he leaned across the table toward Toole.
Otis, Terry interjected, are you lying today? Are you sure you didn't kill Adam Walsh? Now, come on now. Let's don't do it this way. Look at me. Look at me, Otis.
But Toole wouldn't look at Terry.
My mind ain't gonna take much more of this shit, he mumbled.
Then he began to cry.
Just tell me the truth, Terry said quietly. That's all I want to know.
Through his sobs, Toole shook his head.
No, I didn't kill Adam Walsh.
Terry ventured a glance at Hoffman, who wore his characteristic scowl of disgust, then turned back to Toole.
Are you sure, or are you not sure?
Toole was still staring down at the interview table.
I'm sure I didn't, he said.
How are you sure? Terry persisted. What makes you sure you didn't kill Adam Walsh?
Toole finally looked up at Terry, his voice plaintive.
Because if I was really sure, I could come up with his body, he said.
Hoffman broke in then, demanding to know where Toole had come up with all the details he'd been giving them about the crime.
I made it all up,
Toole said in an anguished voice, and then he began to cry again. It was enough for Hoffman. He glanced at his watch and saw that it was 10:30 in the evening. They'd been listening to Toole ramble on for 45 minutes, and they were just going in circles. He snapped his notebook shut and stood to leave the interview room. Terry, however, stayed behind with Toole. For the next 10 minutes, while Toole wailed in misery, Terry sat patiently, making the occasional reassuring sound, gradually calming the prisoner down. Finally, Toole stopped sobbing and appeared to pull himself together.
You okay now? Terry asked.
He glanced at his watch. It had been exactly 12 minutes since Hoffman left the room.
Toole nodded.
I need to talk to that guy again, Toole said.
Terry glanced toward the door through which Hoffman had departed.
Detective Hoffman?
Toole nodded again.
And why do you need to talk to him? Terry inquired carefully.
Because I wasn't telling the truth just now, Toole said, about not killing Adam Walsh.
Terry nodded. I'll just go get him then.
In his fifth interview regarding the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh, recorded shortly after Terry brought Hoffman back to the interview room that night, Toole spoke calmly and in an assured tone of voice, adding details to his account that he had not included in any of his previous statements. He told of walking directly from the Jacksonville Greyhound station to the yard of the roofing company where he knew the Cadillac he'd given back to Faye McNett was stored. He used the keys he'd kept to get inside the fence and took the car, driving to the burned-out site of his mother's home. From under what was left of the front porch, he dug up the can he'd used as a bank and pocketed the $300 or so that was there, then went down to the gas station on the corner, filled the tank, and got on I-95, headed south toward Miami.
I had everything right in the car, he told Hoffman. I had all kinds of tools, a shovel, a machete underneath the seat.
As to his encounter with the child outside the store, Toole was even more forthcoming.
He told me his name was Adam, that his mom was in the store shopping. He told me he liked baseball, that he was playing on some kind of little league team, Toole recalled.
He liked talking to the boy, and it was then that he decided that he was going to take him and raise him for himself. As to the moments when his plans began to fall apart, Toole was appallingly graphic.
He was crying more and getting a little bit louder, and so that's when I really did slap the daylights out of him. I slapped him pretty darn hard. I slapped him dead in the face, dead across the eyes. But it seemed not to be enough. He kept getting a little bit wilder, and I hit him real hard in his stomach, and that would take the wind out of him. And I did punch him in the eyes a couple times more than a couple of times. Finally, Tool said, I really hit him hard in the stomach. I grabbed onto his throat and started choking him with both hands. He was unconscious. He never gained consciousness.
Tool took the detectives back through his account of finding a place to pull off the turnpike, of stopping the Cadillac at the fork he'd mentioned in the service road, and of carrying Adam's body out.
I pulled the bayonet out from underneath the seat, he said, repeating the use of that term for the weapon before he began once again to refer to it as a machete. And then Tool said, Well, I'd done chopped him down. I chopped his head off. I had to come down real hard.
After it was done, Tool said, I pulled his shirt off, wrapped his head up in it, and put it in the car.
When he finally decided that he should get rid of Adam's head, he had been driving no more than 5 or 10 minutes. That is when he spotted the canal and the wooden bridge and pulled over and threw the head into the water. He stood and watched to be sure it would sink, and then he turned and got back into the Cadillac. He drove to the next rest plaza and pulled in beside the entrance to a gas station restroom where he went in to clean up and all. Got all this blood off me. He filled his tank then and drove back to Jacksonville to the site of his mother's burned-out house, where he parked and slept in the car through the night. In the morning, he woke and cleaned up the car and his tools, and that was pretty much that. Detective Hoffman noted that it was 11:41 p.m. when he asked Tool his final question of the evening. Just why was it that Tool had lied to him earlier about not having killed Adam Walsh, Hoffman wanted to know. Tool shrugged.
I couldn't get my head together, he told the detective, as if that ought to explain everything.
While it was surely a blow to Hoffman that Tool had briefly recanted his confession, a more experienced homicide investigator might have reassured the Hollywood detective that this was not out of the ordinary. According to Tool's own words, the killing of that little boy was the worst thing that he had ever done. And while it is not out of the ordinary for a guilty person to confess in order to find some peace, neither is it unusual for that same person to later recant. The reasons are many. Fear of reprisal, a wave of psychological denial that one has actually done the worst thing possible, and on and on. Furthermore, if one were looking for the model of rational behavior, you wouldn't be searching among convicted killers in the first place. The fact remained that Otis Tool had confessed to this killing on multiple occasions, citing details that only someone who'd been present could have known. But Hoffman had not joined the Hollywood Police Department until late in 1975, and he served as a uniform patrolman for nearly 3 years before he was transferred to the Criminal Investigations Division as a detective. When he took over the investigation of the Adam Walsh case, he had less than 3 years of time in grade as an investigator and no experience at all with a case of such magnitude and difficulty. If his reputation as a know-it-all was merited, such an individual would be especially prone to second-guessing himself in his heart of hearts. Furthermore, one might wonder why on earth the detective did not take this opportunity to question Tool as to whether or not he'd had an encounter with a young girl in a Kmart during his foray to Hollywood back in 1981. After all, only 2 days before, Hoffman had listened to Arlene Meyer and her daughter Heidi describe their frightening evening in minute detail, and witnessed them independently identify Tool's photograph as the man they had seen. Had Tool verified the encounter, which had not been reported anywhere, it would have placed Tool in Hollywood at the time of Adam's murder, and in all likelihood, put the matter to rest. Vero Beach, Florida, October 27, 1983. The following Thursday morning, Judge Trowbridge of the 19th Judicial Circuit of Florida, which includes Indian River County, where the crime was presumed to have occurred, ordered the appointment of a temporary public defender for Tool. Before a local defender could be appointed, however, Elton H. Schwartz, an attorney practicing in Miami, drawn by the publicity inherent in the case, offered his services to Toole free of charge. Subsequently, the court, now absolved of any expense in the matter, approved the arrangement. While that was going on, Detective Hoffman set out on his rounds about Jacksonville, trying to substantiate the details of Toole's story. First, Hoffman tracked down Fay McNett, who in fact recalled selling a 1971 Cadillac to Toole. It was a white car with a black vinyl top, a four-door, McNett said, and while Toole wanted it badly, he didn't have enough money to pay for it. He gave her a few dollars down, she recalls, and agreed to have her take $20 or $25 a week out of his paycheck until the balance was satisfied. Ultimately, he told her he couldn't keep up the payments and would have to return the car, which she then kept in the roofing company's compound. If he had an extra set of keys to the car and was prone to borrowing it, she hadn't known about it, but sure, she supposed it was possible. Lots of people had keys to the yard fence, McNett said. That was just how it was. After he spoke with McNett, Hoffman interviewed John Reeves, Jr., owner of Southeast Color Coat, and the son of John Reeves, Sr., owner of Reeves Roofing, where Toole had also worked occasionally. The last day Toole had received any pay for either company was June 4, 1981, Reeves said after a check of his records. Furthermore, Reeves did remember getting a phone call from the Salvation Army in Newport News, Virginia. They'd wanted to confirm that Toole did have a job to return to in Jacksonville, and Reeves had vouched for him. Toole had never actually come back to work at either his company or his father's, though, Reeves Jr. said. As to whether or not Toole had a set of keys to the company compound where McNett's Cadillac was kept, Reeves thought it was possible. One of Toole's responsibilities was to let employees and their trucks in and out of the gate. Meantime, just off Florida's turnpike at mile marker 126 in Indian River County, FDLE technicians were using a front-end loader to excavate the area where their scans had indicated buried objects were to be found. The machine scraped off 4 inches of earth at a time in all 7 spots, down to a depth of 2 feet, but no clothing or remains were found. Also that afternoon, Hoffman received a call from a detective Steve Upkirk of the Oklahoma City Police Department. Based on statements made by Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole, his department had concluded that Toole was likely responsible for somewhere between 4 and 6 unsolved homicides in his jurisdiction, Upkirk said. In addition, there were other unsolved cases in other Oklahoma jurisdictions that Toole was probably responsible for as well. It wasn't necessarily information that would help Hoffman in his own investigation, but it did seem to confirm that Otis Toole was a very bad person indeed. With him in prison, the world was surely a better place. On the following morning, Friday, October 28th, Hoffman's boss, Hollywood Chief of Police Sam Martin, found a letter from an attorney's office in Miami waiting for him when he came to work. It was a notice from Elton Schwartz, Toole's newly appointed public defender, advising Martin that forthwith his men were to cease interviewing his client unless Schwartz was present. At the same time, Hoffman was at the offices of Southeast Color Coat in Jacksonville, where clerk Eileen Knight dug out records to show that Otis Toole had been employed by the company from 1976 through June 4, 1981. She did find that Toole had returned for work at the company after that, but it was only for a single day in December of 1981. Toole had not worked for the company since, Knight was certain. Next, Hoffman tracked down Georgia Toole, Otis's sister-in-law, who confirmed that she had in fact tried to have him arrested for stealing her pickup truck, just as the sheriff's records showed. She also told Hoffman where he could find Norvella Rita Toole, Otis's wife. Rita told Hoffman that she had married Toole on January 14, 1977, and that in fact they were still married to that day. But, she told Hoffman, he was always running me off, and I couldn't figure it out, and one day I got thinking. I said, well, what would a man tell his wife to leave all the time for, unless there's something wrong? Rita told Hoffman that she was away from Otis so much that there wasn't really a lot she could tell him. The only thing, Otis was good to me, and that's all I know. He never mistreated me. He never beat me. He always called me baby.
and I was kind of shocked when I heard all this.
Following his interview with Rita, Hoffman met briefly with Vernon Toole, Otis's brother, and then with Mac Calder, a foreman for the roofing company, but obtained little of use from either. A bit after 3 p.m. that Friday, Hoffman interviewed John Reeves Sr., the owner of Reeves Roofing. He confirmed that Toole had worked for him at times and was responsible for cleaning the compound and had access to the company gas pump and keys. He also told Hoffman that owing to a number of thefts on company property, he had all the locks changed back in 1982, sometime after Toole had left his employment. Reeves remembered that Faye McNett had sold her Cadillac to Toole, and he assured Hoffman that indeed his company kept a number of tools on the property, including crowbars, shovels, and the like. When Hoffman asked if they had any machetes, Reeves thought about it.
"I believe we got one or two of them, too," he said. "It had a wood handle, I'd say about 10 or 12 inches, but I don't remember seeing it lately."
At the conclusion of their interview, Reeves Sr. took Hoffman out to the company tool shed to look around for the machete, but they had no luck. For all his work in Jacksonville, Hoffman had developed little of value. On the one hand, he had ruled out any possibility that Toole had been working for his old employers on Monday, July 27, 1981, the day that Adam was abducted, but on the other, he had found no one who could place Otis Toole in any specific location, particularly Hollywood, between July 26th and July 30th. This makes the failure to corroborate Toole's encounter with Heidi Meyer all the more confounding. In any case, while Hoffman had been busy with his interviews, Buddy Terry had set to work on actually finding the Cadillac that Toole claimed he had used during the abduction and murder, and which Faye McNett had long since sold. Terry finally tracked the then-12-year-old vehicle to an outfit called Wells Brothers Used Cars at 4334 Brentwood Avenue in Jacksonville, and found that indeed it was a black-over-white four-door model with a black leather-like interior, a black dashboard, black carpeting, and power window and door locks that could be controlled by a master panel in the driver's armrest. On Monday, October 31st, technicians from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement were dispatched to pick up the Cadillac from the Wells Brothers lot and take it to the FDLE crime lab on Platon Road in Jacksonville, where it was to be examined for fingerprints, blood, and fibers. That same day, Public Defender Schwartz met with his client for the first time, and on Tuesday, the attorney announced to reporters in Tallahassee that Otis Toole now claimed that he did not murder Adam Walsh or anyone else. "Otis Toole has denied every one of the crimes he's confessed to," Schwartz somewhat predictably said. Asked to comment, Hollywood Chief of Police Martin told the Associated Press that he felt his department still had a prime suspect in the case. On that same Tuesday, Detectives Hoffman and Hickman were still in Jacksonville, interviewing Howard Toole, Otis's brother, at a halfway house. "Yes," Howard told the detectives, "when he found out that Otis was back in Jacksonville on August 1st, 1981, he had gone to Betty Goodyear's rooming house to confront his brother about the theft of the pickup, and in fact he had chased him down to the nearby mini-mart where he caught Otis and slapped him around. But as far as Otis having keys to the Reeves roofing compound or driving a 1971 black-over-white Cadillac, Howard claimed to have no knowledge. Nor did he know that Otis had been hospitalized in Newport News. It was not unusual for Otis to take off for weeks at a time without notifying him or anyone else in the family," Howard told Hoffman. On Wednesday, November 2, 1983, FDLE technicians began their processing of the 1971 Cadillac that Otis said he'd been driving when he kidnapped and killed Adam Walsh. 5 rolls of film were used in photographing the interior and exterior of the vehicle, and the carpets were removed to be treated with luminol, a substance that glows when it comes in contact with blood. In addition, the car was vacuumed and hair samples retained. Following all that, the vehicle was turned over to technicians in the latent prints section for processing. The various samples were sent off to the department's microanalysis section in Tallahassee and its serology lab in Jacksonville, while the photographs were retained by FDLE's Jacksonville office. On the same day, Detective Hoffman spoke with Spencer Bennett of Spencer Motors
at 1401 North Main Street in Jacksonville. Bennett claimed to have known Toole since he was 17, and also said that he had sold him a two-door white Cadillac in 1982. That car had ended up with Otis's brother Howard, Bennett said, because, once again, Otis couldn't keep up the payments. Bennett described Toole as a quiet, meek individual, and if he was in fact a homosexual, Bennett said, it was news to him. Hoffman then asked Bennett if he knew if Otis ever carried a knife or machete around with him. Bennett told Hoffman that in fact he had found a machete in one of his vehicles a while back, though he didn't remember exactly when or which car he'd found it in. He rummaged around in a closet and finally produced a machete with a wooden handle wrapped in black electrician's tape and housed in a green canvas sheath. The blade was rusty and had what looked like tar smeared on it. Hoffman was welcome to it, Bennett said. Hoffman took the machete and traveled to the offices of Reeves Roofing, where he showed it to John Reeves Sr. Reeves glanced at the machete, but said it didn't look familiar. For whatever reason, Hoffman didn't bother to show the blade either to John Reeves Jr. at Southeast Color Coat or to company foreman Mac Calder, both of whom worked more closely with Toole. While he was at the offices, however, Hoffman did take a statement from Helen Reeves, who told him that she had heard from a neighbor, Catherine Butler, that back in 1982, quite often a white car would turn up at the company gates after everyone had gone home. Whoever was in that white car would enter and leave the compound at will, Butler told Mrs. Reeves. From Reeves Roofing, Hoffman drove back to Wells Brothers Used Cars to check on the provenance of the 1971 black-over-white Cadillac that FDLE was now processing. The records were spotty, but it appeared that they'd had the car since sometime in the summer of 1982. They'd sold the car to a person named Ronald Williams on December 31st of that year for $1,569.75, but Williams had defaulted on the payments and they'd had to repossess it. The Wells brothers had had the car to themselves again until Detective Terry showed up and the FDLE came to take it away. If all this seemed less than consequential, Hoffman had something of a more interesting conversation that evening at the Duval County Jail, where he interviewed Bobby Lee Jones, who not only had worked with Toole at Reeves Roofing and Southeast Color Coat, but had recently shared a cell with Toole for about a month. In the days that the two of them had worked together, Jones told Hoffman, he knew that Toole had what he described as an 18-inch butcher knife with a wooden handle under the driver's seat of his car. Toole's car was a white 72 Cadillac with a dent in the right side of the rear bumper, Jones said. He remembered the dent clearly because he had put it there. I ran into the back of him, Jones said. I never said anything about it, but I remember that dent. Jones said that Toole always carried a big ring of keys when he was working for the company and would often disappear from work for several days. He'd show up and explain that he'd been partying, Jones said, though Toole also claimed that he burned down houses for money. As to their recent time together in the Duval County Jail, Jones told Hoffman that Toole had told him all about the kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh. He said that Toole talked about driving up and talking to the boy and making friends with him, and then for some reason starting to beat him up and cutting him apart with a big knife. I told him to shut up and lay down, Jones said. Following his conversation with Jones, Hoffman then interviewed James Collins, a.k.a. Julius Riley Wilkes, the other cellmate who had also worked with Toole at Southeast Color Coat. According to Collins, it was common knowledge that Toole was gay. Collins related an on-the-job incident at Southeast Color Coat where another worker was making deprecating remarks to Toole about his lover, Henry Lee Lucas. According to Collins, Toole didn't say much, but simply walked off the job abruptly. A few minutes later, Toole returned to work in his Cadillac with a shotgun under his arm. He approached the man who had been making fun of Lucas and pointed the barrel of the shotgun in the man's face. "Just keep on talking and I'll blow your brains out," Collins reported Toole as saying. When Hoffman asked Collins to describe the car that Toole was driving that day, he replied that it was either white or black, one of the two. In any case, Collins thought it looked like the Cadillac that was on the news just the other day. It was toward the end of this interview
that Collins divulged the recent conversations he'd had with Toole in their cell about the fact that he was leaving jail to help the cops in Fort Lauderdale look for the body of a child he'd killed down there, and his fears as to what other inmates might do to a fellow convict known to have murdered children. On the following morning, Thursday, November 3rd, Hoffman drove the 40 miles to Rayford, where he interviewed a man named James Michael Poole, who'd shared a cell with Otis Toole in the Butler Transient Unit back in July. Poole told Hoffman that Toole had made various strange statements about being in the child repossession business. Another time, he told Poole that he had taken his own son from Broward County, and that somewhere on their way back to Jacksonville, he had just dropped the boy off along the highway. Poole thought that odd, because the boy was supposedly only 7 or 8 years old, but then again, people did strange things, especially the kind of people you meet in jail. While at Rayford, Detective Hoffman also spoke with Boyd Earl Gilbert, another cellmate of Toole's in the Butler Transient Unit. Gilbert told Hoffman that the two of them had met on August 31st, some 2 months previously, and that at that time Toole claimed that up until the time of his imprisonment, he had been earning a living burning down buildings for people who wanted to collect the insurance. Unfortunately, there'd been an old man sleeping in the last place he burned down, and the guy died. During that same conversation, Gilbert said, Toole also told him that he had murdered a little kid down around West Palm Beach, the son of a policeman. Though it might seem a puzzling claim, it is quite possible that Toole had confused the adult-sized boat captain's hat Adam was wearing when he was taken with the similarly styled patrolman's dress cap worn by most South Florida cops at the time. In any case, if Gilbert was being truthful, it meant that Toole was talking openly about his involvement in the killing of Adam Walsh for more than a month before he'd made his first formal confession to Detective Kendrick of Brevard County on October 10th. As Hoffman was conducting these interviews at Rayford, Buddy Terry took the machete that Hoffman had picked up at Bennett Motors to the FDLE offices in Jacksonville to have it tested for blood. Technicians had already identified 8 different areas of carpet and padding from the floorboards of Toole's Cadillac to test for blood as well. Terry was hopeful that something would come of the tests, of course, but his mind kept wandering to what awaited him at his next stop. A call had come into his office the previous evening from Otis Toole, something Terry was hardly expecting, given the public pronouncements of his newly appointed attorney. Toole had said that he needed to speak with Terry right away. He was upset with this lawyer from Miami who'd come up to talk with him. According to Toole's message, the guy was actually trying to get him to say he wasn't guilty of the murder of Adam Walsh. Jacksonville, Florida, November 3, 1983. Otis Toole's 7th recorded statement to police regarding the murder of Adam Walsh began shortly after noon on November 3rd with a preamble from Detective Terry. I came to the county jail to talk to you because you contacted Detective Ron Carul and told him that you wanted me to come over and talk to you, Terry said. Is that correct? It was indeed correct, Toole assured him. The lawyer I had from Miami and the lawyer I got in Jacksonville told me that I don't have to talk with you at all, Toole said. But I still want to talk to you. And the detective is trying to get me to say I ain't guilty on the Adam Walsh case. Terry looked at Toole closely. The detective or the attorney? He asked. I mean the attorney, Toole answered. I really know myself that I really did kill Adam Walsh, but the lawyer I got from Miami, he's trying to tell me I didn't kill Adam Walsh. Though it was frustrating, Detective Terry told Toole that he was sorry, but they could go no further. They couldn't talk about Adam Walsh anymore, not without Toole's attorney present. Whether he liked it or not, Toole had a lawyer now. They could talk about other things, Terry said, but their private conversations about Adam Walsh were at an end. That same afternoon, Detective Hoffman drove from Rayford another 3.5 hours south to a state of Florida foster care facility in Lakeland, Florida, where he interviewed Frank Powell, Otis Toole's nephew and brother of Frieda Becky Powell. Young Frank told Hoffman that he had not seen Otis Toole since they were all separated one night on their way up to Maryland back in July 1981. He told Hoffman that he often rode around Jacksonville with his uncle, and that he had been with him on several visits to Reeves Roofing and Southeast Color Coat when Otis used keys on his ring to unlock the gates so that he could fire up the tar kettles and such. And Frank also remembered that Otis kept a leather-sheathed hunting knife under the front seat of his black-over-white Cadillac. He'd had the car in 1980 and 81, Frank said, and had used it even after he'd had to give it back to Mrs. McNett. All the information seemed to confirm that Toole, in fact, had access to a car that he could have used to drive to Miami, one with a resemblance to a car seen in the vicinity of the abduction of Adam Walsh. Also, it seemed that Toole probably had kept a sizable bladed weapon of some sort under the seat of that car. But aside from the reported sighting of Toole by a woman and her daughter in a Hollywood Kmart a day or two before Adam's disappearance, and Toole's apparently wobbly confessions to the crime, Hoffman had still not come up with the solid evidence he was after. He thanked young Powell for his help and began the long drive back to Jacksonville. Early on Friday morning, as Toole was being escorted by Detective Terry toward an interview room in the Duval County Jail, where yet another team of out-of-state homicide detectives were waiting to interview him regarding a set of unsolved cases, Toole glanced down the hallway to see Detectives Hoffman and Hickman conversing with each other, and he called out to them. He'd remembered this church where he used to work back in 1981. It was out off Lane Avenue near I-10, Toole told them, near a Days Inn. Maybe they could track it down and find out exactly what days he was working, Toole told the detectives. Detective Terry suspected that Toole's attorney wouldn't be happy with his client's offer of such information, but since Toole had initiated the conversation, it did not violate counsel's dictates that no interview be scheduled independently. Certainly Terry made no move to intervene. Hoffman and Hickman made a note of Toole's information and told him they'd look into it. First, though, the two Hollywood detectives followed up with Betty Goodyear to see if they could confirm the date when Toole had moved into one of her houses with his erstwhile wife, Rita. As was the case with employment records, any piece of evidence that would place Toole in Jacksonville on July 27, 1981, would render all of his statements regarding Adam Walsh null and void. But Goodyear insisted that if she did nothing else, she kept accurate records. She produced a pair of receipt books for the period in question, the first of which showed that she had rented a room to Otis Toole on July 31, 1981. She also showed them another book with a copy of a receipt made out to V. Toole on August 7th. Toole did have a brother named Vernon, but as to why his name was in her book, Goodyear did not know. From there, Hoffman and Hickman traveled to University Hospital, where Otis's wife Rita was a patient. When they asked her about Betty Goodyear's records, Rita cleared the mystery up quickly. She'd moved out of living with Otis shortly after they'd reunited there at the end of July and moved in with his brother Vernon for a week. Since he paid the rent, that's why his name was on the receipt. As for her time together with Otis during that period, it began the day she moved into the Goodyear apartments on July 31st. She'd been staying with a woman named Nancy Jackson for 7 or 8 months before that, and she hadn't seen Otis at all during that time. The two detectives left University Hospital to follow up on Toole's recollection that he had done some work for a church around the time of Adam Walsh's murder. After some digging, they finally found a Church of God next to a Days Inn just south of I-10, about 15 minutes west of downtown. The church's pastor, Reverend Cecil Wiggins, didn't recall anyone named Toole ever working for him, but, prodded by the detectives, he agreed to consult his records. Somewhat to his surprise, the good reverend discovered that the church had, in fact, paid Toole for lawn maintenance work on two separate occasions in 1981, $17.50 on August 27th and $22.75 on August 28th. Hoffman and Hickman could only stare at each other. After all their digging, they had been able to place Otis Toole in Jacksonville on July 25th when he'd arrived from Virginia on a Greyhound bus, and they knew that he was back again on July 31st when he'd rented a room for himself and his wife from Betty Goodyear. But as to where he was during the time in between, and especially on the afternoon and evening of July 27th when Adam Walsh was kidnapped and murdered,
They had only the sighting reported by Heidi and Arlene Meyer and the word of Toole to go on. Given the amount of time that Hoffman had spent in Jacksonville talking to Toole's family and associates, it might seem in hindsight that he was more intent on proving that Toole was in that city on July 27th and thus could not possibly have committed the murder of Adam Walsh than he was with trying to find evidence placing Toole in South Florida at the time. Perhaps Hoffman was simply following the line of least resistance in interviewing individuals who knew Toole and might exonerate him, but it is puzzling, at the very least, why Hoffman or his team did not expend a greater effort on trying to place Toole at the scene of the crime, broadcasting appeals to witnesses in local media, for instance, or canvassing the ranks of Sears shoppers. Possibly it seemed easier to Hoffman to track down and talk to people who knew Toole than to search for needles in the haystacks of South Florida. Possibly, given his relative inexperience with crimes of such magnitude, he was simply out of his depth as an investigator. Or possibly he simply believed Toole was lying when he said that he had kidnapped and murdered Adam Walsh. Were this his reasoning, though, he had committed the cardinal sin of an investigator, allowing his subjective feelings to interfere with his work. And whatever his reasoning, it seems odd that Hoffman was spending most of his time and effort trying to prove that the person who had confessed to the crime did not do it instead of the other way around. In any case, and out of Leeds and Jacksonville for the time being, Hoffman and Hickman returned to Hollywood to await the results of the various tests being performed by the FDLE labs. On the following Wednesday, November 9th, Hollywood Police Chief Sam Martin called Hoffman in to share the report that the FDLE had finally sent him. The 8 sections of carpet and padding from the front and rear floorboards of the Cadillac had been treated with luminol to indicate the presence of blood, the report noted, and areas of strongly persistent luminescence were observed on the portion of carpet taken from the driver's side floor, the carpet from the left rear floorboard, and on the padding beneath the carpet on the left rear floorboard. While it would have taken a considerable quantity of blood to soak through the carpet and into the padding itself, the report stated that, given the amount of time that had passed and the limitations of DNA technology at the time, there was an insufficient amount of blood present for further testing. As to the machete that Hoffman had confiscated at Bennett Motors, chemical tests on the blade edge also demonstrated that traces of blood were present, but once again, the quantity found was insufficient to allow for further testing. While such results may seem maddeningly inconclusive to a present-day audience conditioned by the mind-boggling feats achieved by CSI investigators on contemporary television, those were the unequivocal findings of the most sophisticated crime technicians working in Florida law enforcement at the time. Tests for blood on the canvas sheath of the machete were also inconclusive, the report added. And as for other debris found on the blade and sheath, that would be examined by FDLE's microanalysis section in Tallahassee. 5 rolls of film had been taken to document the various forensic procedures performed on the Cadillac, the report noted, though the disposition of that film was not made clear. The thought of setting science aside for the moment and simply showing the machete to the several people who had reported seeing Otis Toole in possession of such a weapon might have occurred to almost anyone at that point. After all, Hoffman had gone to the trouble of taking it to one of Toole's employers for the purposes of identification. But if Chief Martin or Detective Hoffman or anyone else at HPD thought of such a low-tech undertaking, there is no indication of it. Williamson County, Texas, November 12, 1983. In November 1983, 2 days before what would have been the celebration of Adam Walsh's 9th birthday, Henry Lee Lucas wrote from his jail cell in Texas to his former lover and partner in crime, Otis Toole. He wasn't sure if word had reached Toole yet, but Lucas wanted him to know that he had confessed to the murder of Toole's niece, Becky Powell. Lucas hadn't written sooner regarding the matter, he explained, because he didn't want to hurt Toole. Despite the fact that he had killed her, Lucas assured Toole that Becky had been his life. "I loved her more than anything else," he said, and then, having dispensed with that matter, went on to ask Toole for help in piecing together the details of the many crimes they had committed together, so we can get the whole thing out in the open. Lucas had not yet implicated Toole in anything, he said, but he had found considerable peace in coming clean, and he was writing now to find out if Toole as well might be willing to talk about their various misdeeds. On Monday, November 14th, Lucas followed up with a phone call, one that was being tape-recorded by the Texas Rangers, a fact that Lucas passed along to Toole at the beginning of their conversation. Certainly, the warning did not deter Toole from being forthright. "Remember that one time I said I wanted me some ribs?" Toole asked Lucas. "Did that make me a cannibal?" "You wasn't a cannibal," Lucas assured him. "It's the force of the devil. Something forced on us that we can't change. There's no denying what we become," he added. "We know what we are." Toole seemed quick to pick up on Lucas's theme. "Remember how I liked to pour some blood out of them?" Once again, Lucas, whose first murder victim was his own mother in 1960, seemed compassionate and reasoned. "Otis, you and I have something people look on as an animal. There's no way of changing what we done, but we can stop it and not allow other people to become what we have. And the only way to do that is by honesty." Apparently, Lucas had achieved some sense of salvation by baring his soul to investigators about his many misdeeds, quite a few of them fanciful, as it turned out, and it seemed as if his words had some effect on Toole. The following day, Tuesday, November 15th, Toole was interviewed by Calcasieu Parish Chief of Detectives Donnie Fitz about the murder of 20-year-old Catherine Martin back in 1982 near Lake Charles, Louisiana. She'd been stabbed 16 times with a screwdriver. "Yeah, he had done it," Toole said, and his account of the crime reflected that he saw nothing unusual in his choice of weapons. If you had a hammer, you'd use a hammer. If there was a knife, use a knife. What was so different between a knife and a screwdriver anyway? As he was winding up his interview with Toole, Fitz casually tossed out something he'd heard in the hallway. "We understand you say you really didn't kill Adam Walsh," Fitz said to Toole, who seemed surprised by the statement. "Oh no, I killed him too. There's no doubt about that," Toole replied. "It was like the kid, he wouldn't shut up. I was driving him in the car. I slapped him. I hit him several times." Fitz gave an interview to reporters concerning his own investigation of the murder of Catherine Martin, but thought enough of what he'd heard from Toole about the Walsh case to pass that information along as well. Thus, in a story published on November 23rd in the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel, the public was assured once again by Toole that he was the man responsible. Meanwhile, Detective Hoffman had returned to Jacksonville yet again, looking for something that would pin down Toole's whereabouts between July 25th and July 31st, 1981. On Thursday morning, November 17th, Hoffman went to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office Homicide Unit to meet with Buddy Terry. Toole was in the unit as well on this day, being interviewed by detectives from agencies near Houston and others from Colorado. The door to the interview room was open, and when Toole glanced up to see Hoffman walking by, he called out after the detective. "Hey, Jack," he said, "I need to speak with you." Hoffman grudgingly stopped to acknowledge Toole. "So where's Detective Hickman?" Toole wanted to know. Hoffman glanced at his two colleagues. "He's back in Hollywood," Hoffman said to Toole. "This is Lieutenant Smith and Sergeant Stanley," he added, "and neither one of them believe a thing you've said about Adam Walsh." Toole had already complained to Detectives Kendrick from Brevard County and Villa from Louisiana that he didn't like the way that Hoffman treated him. Hoffman had called him a retard and an asshole on several occasions the day they were out there by Florida's turnpike looking for the body, Toole said, and that really pissed him off. "I know I'm an asshole," Toole told Kendrick earlier, "and I am a retard. But if the Hollywood cops thought they were so smart, then let them go find Adam's body themselves. That's what he'd decided." Thus, it is not difficult to imagine what Toole thought of the three Hollywood cops glowering at him from the hallway. Hoffman would later note in his log that Toole seemed quite upset, in fact. "You want me to go on national TV and state that I killed Adam Walsh?" Toole called angrily to Hoffman. But despite the fact that he had no other leads in the case of a lifetime, Hoffman apparently felt he'd already been sufficiently played the fool by Otis Toole. He simply shrugged and led the other officers away down the hall. That day, Hoffman looked at medical records supplied by jailers that indicated that since his arrival, Toole had been receiving 50 milligrams of Benadryl at bedtime, presumably to help him fall asleep, along with regular dosages of Meladryl, an herbal supplement sometimes used in the treatment of herpes. Though medical records showed that he had been diagnosed as having suffered convulsions from grand mal epilepsy some 15 years previously, Toole was taking no epilepsy medication at Duval County. Little of import there, it seemed. On the following day, Hoffman interviewed Toole's stepfather, Robert Harley, who told the detective that he had married Toole's mother, Sarah, in 1957, when Toole was 10. He told Hoffman of the thefts that occurred from his home after Toole's mother died, and of his suspicions that